Shalom Ayudim, Shalom Lebnei Noach, Shalom Goyim. It's the evening of the fourth day, Yud Be'iyal, Parashas Bechal, Tavshinayim Vav, the evening of the third day, Tuesday, 17 May 2016, webcasting from Israel, squabbling still over the Bibi versus Bogey brouhaha. At the same time, Bibi is negotiating with Bougie over joining his cabinet so that he can get rid of Bennett, who's a nuisance, who does not know how to fulfill the role of a subordinate, not one striving to depose his prime minister. And this is one of the most annoying features of Israeli life, this political strife and the making of coalitions and the breaking of them. And as far as I can tell, this does not benefit John Q. Public, although I guess here it would be Yochanan Kovtzibo. These people make very nice salaries and spend an inordinate amount of time playing these power games, so to speak, on company time. It's simply revolting that the taxpayers pay for all these man-hours that never benefit the common man in Israel. It's Bibi versus Bogey and Bibi versus Bougie. Bibi, Bogey, and Bougie. Sounds like a vaudeville act. The friction between the first two, Bibi and Bogey, has been the top story for like a week now, over Yair Golan's shocking insinuation that some Israelis were acting like proto-Nazis toward the ancient ones, and that the country had to wake up. And as I suggested before in an earlier webcast, what's in play here is the community of collectivists in the kibbutzim and moshavim that have dominated the IDF since day one. There's a group think in the IDF, as in other affinity groups, and as I suggested, what we hear from Yair Golan was the worldview of these post-religious Israelis of Jewish extraction, whose self-definition is such that it leads them to perceive the Holocaust their way, as it could happen to, as if it could happen to any people. Any people could become Nazis, given the same political processes, even Jews, in their animosity to what Israeli icon Moshe Dayan might have called the victims of Zionism. Moshe Dayan and his Sabra generation, the heroes of Leon Uris' historical romance Exodus, insisted they were Israelis and not Jews, and would not be so ghettoized and have compassion for the other. I was married an Israeli who was raised in a communist family, insisted she was an Israeli and not a Jew. The whole purpose of Israel for her and her family was to leave the Jews behind, those wimps who walked like sheep into the gas chambers. And as no longer Jews, they had become, Israelis like her, normal. And anti-Semitism had nothing to do with her. It was something for the Jews in the diaspora. They suffer from acts of anti-Semitism, but not in Israel. Here it's a national conflict between two normal nations, Israelis and ancient ones. And here was J-Post yesterday, writing up the ambush stabbing in Jerusalem, which happened, you know, where else, Damascus Gate. Here is the lead in this morning's paper, quote, "A Palestinian man stabbed and slightly wounded a Jewish youth near the old city's Damascus Gate in East Jerusalem on Monday morning," close quote. And later we learned that the stabber was caught by the police and he is a, quote, "resident of the West Bank." And I wondered, what would this sound like if a different vocabulary was used, not to begin with a Palestinian man, for there's nothing Palestinian about this guy for sure, but with a Muslim man stabbed and slightly wounded a Jewish youth. And by deleting the words old city and east, we would say this Israeli youth was stabbed near Damascus Gate in Jerusalem by a resident not of the West Bank, but Judea and Samaria. And then the post lead would be, "A Muslim man, a resident of Judea and Samaria, stabbed and slightly wounded a Jewish youth near Damascus Gate in Jerusalem." My point is that the Israelis, like these post-staffers, J-post-staffers, dominated, by the way, by the non-Orthodox, they are as much at fault, as all of Israel's MSM journalists are, in their vocabulary that skews the story to suit their ideology and by their vocabulary maintain the separation that they complain about. I find it an offense against truthful journalism calling this 20-something male with a knife in his hand a Palestinian when there's nothing Palestinian about him. He is indistinguishable from the Arabs in Jordan and in Syria and Iraq. The only distinctions are accent, which is a meaningless distinction. There are 50 states in the United States, and there are hundreds of regional accents. But all its citizens belong to one nation. Likewise, the Arab states, 21 of them, with regional dialects. It's still one nation, and it's not as if the Arab nation lacks statehood. With these 21 and a landmass larger than the United States, they don't need another state for their nation. And certainly not at the expense of one tiny Jewish state in the Middle East. But when these Israelis speak of Palestinians, they're creating a separate national identity that needs its own land. In fact, the PLO Covenant of 1964, later revised in 68, opens with a declaration that the Arabs in Palestine are part of the greater Arab nation. It's not a declaration of national independence, but just the opposite. It was a message in its day to fellow Arabs that Palestine belongs to them, and they should help the immediate victims of the Jews to reverse their triumphs and return the land they stole from the Arab people. Come to think of it, this is the mind of the Bedouin, who has been around from time immemorial. Let me change that cliche. We can remember the Arabs have been this way since, if not time immemorial, then the days of Abraham, who had to expel his own firstborn son, the father of the Arabs, who, as Rashi teaches, became a desert-dwelling armed robber. In my book, there are also two women, one English woman, Gertrude Bell, another, an American, Stuart Erskine, her last name was, both in love with the Arabs. And so they enjoyed watching, as they traveled with them as anthropologists unfrocked, watching their tribal raids on one another, great entertainment for them. Life for these Bedouin was tending your goats and your camels, but also attacking other tribes, raiding their encampments, making off with whatever you could, including their women and their animals, in the knowledge that when their victims, taken by surprise, recovered, they would make an attempt at a counter-raid to take back what was taken and even more. This was the lifestyle of the Arabs from the days of Abraham into the 20th century, and their hatred of Israel, I think, is a function of their belief that, as in days of old, the Jews stole what was theirs, and they have the right to strike back and take back what the miserable Jews stole from them. And never mind, we didn't steal anything. If anything, they were the ones guilty of coveting our wealth, the wealth we created here over the previous century of land reclamation and the building of towns and villages and businesses, creating farms in the desert. The Arabs are inveterate thieves, and they cover up their thievery by insisting that the wealth they covet is really theirs and was stolen from them. And they are angry and indignant over the injustice they suffered. And their anger and indignation is more camouflage to their appetite for what does not belong to them. As my book points out, the invention of the Palestinians was the inversion of truth. When it was the Arab-Israeli conflict, 1948-67, the story was of the Arab nation's effort to destroy the new self-governing state of the Jews, no longer subject to Muslim rule. But after 1967, the invention of the Palestinians conjured up a narrative in which it's Israel that is out to prevent statehood to the Palestinians who have been dreaming of their state for thousands of years. The tables are turned. It's the same narrative, but now the roles are switched. The way the central story of Islam is the binding by Ibrahim of his son Ismail, which is the same story, only the roles have been switched. It's the essence, as well, I think, of the recent UNESCO resolution by 33 countries that have chosen to think like David Irving, twisting the truth. Those 33 countries that signed off on that UNESCO resolution believe that the violence here is not about the Jews' self-defense against their neighbors who want to destroy their country and probably kill a lot of Jews in the process, God forbid. No, the violence here is the resistance of the victims of Zionism to the Israelis who won't let them have their self-governing state in their ancient homeland. But I digress. The top story in Israel today remains the strained relations between Bibi and Bogi. Even after their alleged reconciliation, I continue to believe that what is at stake for Bogi, for Yalon and Golan, and their supporters in the army and the country as a whole, is their self-image and their ideology. These IDF generals spent their lives in a hothouse of ideas that were largely the creation of natives like themselves who never experienced anti-Semitism in their lives, their formative years. No classmate on the kibbutz ever pointed a finger at one of them and hissed, "You killed God." What's at stake in Yair Golan's language is the self-definition of a passing generation which is now disturbed by the transformation of their beloved IDF from arrogantly non-religious people like themselves to national religious types, and this transition bothers them.
אבינו מחכה לאורחים, יושב בפתח האוהל, מביט למרחקים. מי כבר יבוא לאמצע המדבר? בחום הגדול לא רואים שום דבר, כחום היום, כחום היום. וואלה איזה חום, אף אחד לא יבוא היום. כחום היום, כחום היום. וואלה איזה חום, אף אחד לא יבוא היום. שלושה אנשים מתקרבים בצעדים רחבים, שרה תכיני מטעמים, רץ לקראתם, מגיש להם מים קרים, מזמין אותם לאוהל, הם נכנסים. כחום היום, כחום היום, הם יושבים ומדברים. כחום היום, כחום היום, כחום היום, הם יושבים ומדברים. כחום היום,
an item from last week that I did not get to, but I don't want to let slip by. It was exactly a week ago that the brand new mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, responded to Donald Trump's idea of closing the doors to Muslims, you know, coming into America. But before I proceed, I don't want to let slip his name, Sadiq. Clearly another mispronunciation of the Hebrew Tzadik, a righteous man. And the odds are great that since Islam emerged almost 2,000 years after Hashem gave the Jews his Torah, For 2,000 years, these uncivilized, meaning uncinified nomads, did not even have a word for righteousness, as they mispronounced the word shalom as salam, so tzaddik came before a sadik. The Ibn Ezra, Rabbi Avraham in medieval Spain, said Arabic was the broken Hebrew of desert illiterates, which makes much sense. The Torah is explicit. Ishmael goes to live in the desert of Paran with his bow and arrow and was simply not a man for book learning and the proper use of language. So for 2,000 years, his seed would remain illiterate after Mamad Sinai. Anyway, back to contemporary times where the new mayor in London, here's the Daily Caller's website headline, quote, London's new mayor warns Trump, colon, let in Muslims or they will attack America. I read that and like now started to chuckle. This is a character who indignantly objects to anyone who thinks a Muslim cannot subscribe to modern liberal democratic values. And here he was, like a Bedouin marauder, threatening the U.S. that if Muslims were blocked from entering, they will attack. It was functionally a confession that Donald Trump is right to want to keep them out. Trump had praised this new mayor and said he would be willing to make an exception for him if he wants to the U.S. and chooses to restrict Muslim entry. But, of course, Khan dismissed the invitation and said Trump's views of Islam were, quote, ignorant. He said his view plays into the hands of extremists and alienates the mainstream Muslims. Quote, Donald Trump and those around him think that Western liberal values are incompatible with mainstream Islam. London has proved him wrong, close quote. The Daily Caller's Blake Neff, the journalist, then took note of a poll last month in the UK that found 66% of Muslims saying they would not tell the government if a friend or family member became involved with extremists. And I say, if so, this is a fifth column in the UK. The indignant Sadiq Khan sees in his own election the compatibility of Islam and Western liberal values when it does nothing of the kind. In order to see true compatibility, Khan would have to explain why not one of the world's officially Muslim states lives by Western liberal values. But worst of all, the unconscious thuggery here, and absent any moral judgment, he does not illuminate why he thinks Trump's ban on Muslims would be an injustice. He responds by threatening that the response will be terrorism, which is why Donald Trump wants to keep them out of the U.S. He makes Trump's point for him. We're dealing with thugs for whom the nasty religion of Islam lets them delude themselves and try to persuade the world into thinking they're not thugs, that they're not highwaymen and armed robbers. If memory serves, it was that crack by Trump that catapulted him to the front of the pack in the primary season, and if he is elected, he has to follow through to some degree on that wish. Well, tactics aside, what I want to see first is a philosophical stance in which political correctness is ignored and the administration, the new one, publicly rules that Islam is not like other religions. Political correctness dictates that all religions are of equal worth, and that idea has to go. It's not true. I think every mosque in the West should be padlocked by the authorities for the illegality of the polygamy that it approves of and practices, which I think is at the root of the degenerate culture that Arab Islam is. And in some kind of supernatural connection, there is a connection between the assault on the West by sexually perverse Islam and the tidal wave of perversion that has swept the West since the 1960s. A few months ago, and not for the first time, I think, the entertainer Beyoncé was the halftime entertainment at the Super Bowl, the most watched program of the year, commonly by family and friends. And there she was, scantily clad, singing and shaking, as if an African fertility rite dance, or what used to be thought of as supremely vulgar, kind of entertainment one found in a strip club. The spoken language has also been dirtied with one filthy word after another, which not coincidentally associates to sex and the organs of evacuation. Trump talks the American argo these days with his own filthy words, and the people, I think, voted for that image, and Donald's one of the people. As I said, after his foreign policy statement, which was great, his domestic side scares me for this builder of gambling casinos and nightclubs in them and golf courses for the rich and his three marriage, and his support for the latest evidence of America's nervous breakdown, this transgender nonsense. Here is its twice-elected president dictating to all the school children in the country that if you're a boy but think you're a girl, use the girls' room. And to hell with the girls inside. Who will object? Because these are bigots who have been socialized by a patriarchal society to greedily think that they have a monopoly on what it means to be a girl. They must learn that you are whatever you think you are. I think the United States, America, is cracking up with last summer's Supreme Court blessing of sodomite and lesbian marriages. The West truly is becoming Sodom and Gomorrah. And while I doubt sulfur and brimstone is on the way, the moral of Sodom and Gomorrah is that, I think, societies that pervert the God-given, God-like ability to create another human being, strip pleasure from procreation, are societies doomed to extinction. And if all the recent demographic studies of Western cultures, countries are correct, that is exactly what's happening. You're listening to www.deprogramprogram.com, broadcasting from the hills of Judea. I'm Shai Ben-Tekoa. Well, we left off with the U.S. crumbling onto the ash heap of history, and I fear the plague there is in its manifestation stage here, too. You know, whatever is up to date in Kansas City, as the old Rodgers and Hammerstein song had it, up to date in the U.S., penetrates Israel. So that today, J-Post reported that the Welfare and Social Service Ministry in Jerusalem announced yesterday the allocation of an additional 3 million shekels to be given to the LGBT community. And not coincidentally, today, May 17, and apparently not for the first time, although it's news to me, this is International Day Against Homophobia, Transphobia, and Biphobia. The ministry said it would focus its efforts on assisting the transgender community in particular. And yours truly insists there's no such thing as homophobia, transphobia, biphobia. These are psychiatric-sounding terms, since it was Freud, I think, who introduced the Greek word phobia into common speech. These terms are the product not of serious students of the mind, psychiatrists, but the victims of these mental disorders in an effort to persuade people not to disapprove of what gives them pleasure. I think sexual deviance is no less an addiction than heroin, and likely even stronger. And the two are related, I believe. Chemically speaking, heroin is a precursor drug to morphine, and the pleasure hormone produced in the pituitary gland in the brain, stimulated by the brain, produces endorphins, and it's no coincidence that the two words, endorphin and morphine, sound alike. The sexually disordered are as much addicted to their own homegrown morphine, endorphins, as any junkie to his smack. In any case, I think the psychiatric profession has been tragically guilty of malpractice, starting in the early 70s, when the Jewish editor of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders declared that homosexuality would no longer be seen as a disorder. He said if homosexuals are happy doing what they do, they're not suffering, so it's not a mental disorder. This fellow just passed away. And it has been downhill ever since, right up to last summer's Supreme Court decision and the lunacy of last week's presidential decree regarding toilets in public schools and other insane decisions by some states to insist that transgenders have a constitutional right to use whatever toilet they want. And, of course, companies have been ordered to build toilets especially for transgenders. And yours truly faults the psychoanalysts and the psychiatrists and the psychologists for never speaking up and saying this is all madness. At the most basic level, the human body does not like what homosexuals do to one another. It is therefore medically contraindicated. Doctors should speak out against the behavior. Back in the 1970s, I was at a dinner party in Beverly Hills, unkosher, of course, and fell into conversation with a local MD who said much of his practice was extracting foreign objects from the lower intestines and repairing other damage done by his patients. I'm as tolerant as the next guy, but this business of not only refraining from disapproval, but actually approving of deviance and accusing those who disapprove, like me, of being bigots, is simply insane. Western society is flying off the handle. It is approaching a tea party conducted by the Mad Hatter. And in a related way, I couldn't believe a news story last Thursday about National Security Advisor Susan Rice delivering a commencement speech in which she said, U.S. security personnel are too white. I read that, and it was another jaw-dropper. Maybe it's her youth. I mean, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. must be spinning in his grave. A. Philip Randolph and Roy Wilkins and Bayard Rustin and other Negro leaders of a half century ago who fought to make skin color irrelevant. And here is Susan Rice, who seems to need a refresher course in high school biology. I took it in the 10th grade. If memory serves, they taught us that your intelligence was in your brain. And preachers would say your character is in your heart. And here is Miss Rice, who seems to think the skin is an organ of thought and character. The culture has spun out of control. Last item, a good news item. Jay Post reported today that the governor of Texas has informed the White House that Obama's request that Texas review its sanctions program against Iran, that will not be heeded. Governor Abbott said the Texas economy is number 12 in the world, on a par with Australia and Canada, and Obama's Iran deal is not popular in the Lone Star State. And he also said in this context, quote, Texas is going to take the lead in sending the message to the international community that we stand with Israel, close quote. Bravo. He's perfectly clear, I think, that the Iran deal is first and foremost directed at Israel. He's no fool. And the people of Texas may be the most pro-Israel community in the 50 states. Maybe when they look at the Israeli flag with one star, they see their own with one star. And there's a tradition in Texas of seeing themselves as a people apart from the rest of the U.S., like the Jews are a people apart. Texas was an independent state for, what, 10 years? Anyway, it is heartwarming that others see through the evil designs of this evil man, who I believe will use his remaining months to do as much evil and more damage to the U.S. as he can before he leaves office, starting with his ridiculous toilet declaration. He has crippled the Navy. He has crippled the Air Force. He sides with the worst of the African Americans in the Ferguson melee. He makes Al Sharpton his advisor. What a piece of work is this menace of a man. Okay, that's it for this Tuesday, and I'll be back, God willing, on Thursday. Until then, Laila Tov, Meretz Yisrael.